So the usual story for emergent geometry is that we may not expect a manifold structure at the quantum gravity scale. Observables such as lengths and volumes should be given by expectation values over superposition of geometric states, and that might not have a nice manifold description. So string theory, of course, an incredibly successful theory of quantum gravity, perturbatively, works around some background metric, and as a result has some built-in assumptions about some underlying manifold structures. And so what some people in the quantum gravity community would like to do is to try to understand a theory that builds a little bit more foundationally and has space-time and emergent macroscopic phenomena. So of course, just like you would have in a solid state system, this would also be prone to geometric defects. And these are objects that could be realized experimentally and actually give us some bounds and constraints on a model such as this. So the framework that I'm going to be talking about today is still very much in its infancy, but it is trying to understand emergent geometry from a purely combinatorial perspective. So it's going to be a little bit different, a little bit more removed from the usual sort of setup, physics setup that we look at. So the framework actually comes equipped with two different paradigms. They're both filled with sort of their interesting own physical questions, and they're sort of disjoint in many ways. But there's sort of a common language that you can use to bridge the two, and we'll find that we can use one of these paradigms as a probe for the other. So we'll make this explicitly clear and talk about these two different paradigms as we go through the talk. So the first paradigm is the paradigm of emergent networks. So in this paradigm, we have a very sort of simple question that we'd like to ask ourselves. That is to say, you have a bag of your favorite geometric building blocks, a bag of your favorite Legos. You don't have any instructions on how they fit together. You don't really know exactly what you'd like to build, and you certainly don't have an instruction set on how to go about building that. And the question is, if you sort of stochastically put things together, what could you expect to get? And the answer, as you should anticipate, is trash. With a set of measure zero, you will reconstruct the Taj Mahal stochastically. So what we would like to do is have some sort of directed growth paradigm. We're going to set up and establish a stochastic process on the space of networks, and we're going to have some cost function that's going to evaluate whether or not a network is good or a network is bad with respect to some metric. And we would like to find the optimal network state that minimizes our cost function. So this is sort of not the usual way that we approach problems in physics. Maybe this is more of like an optimization problem, but it's certainly one of the halves on which this formalism lives. So the other way that we could approach is a much more traditional approach. We can formally define some combinatorial state space. On this space, we're going to explicitly define some action. And according to the traditions of understanding measures on spaces, we can perform some Markov chain Monte Carlo sampling of our measure and try to understand the distribution on this space and build an ensemble of states from which we can probe observables with our usual partition function statistics. So let's just dive right in to what I call a combinatorial state in our space. So a combinatorial state of the kind that we're considering can be represented by a particular form of directed graph. So this graph is rooted. It has a set of root vertices, and all of the edges are oriented outward from these root vertices. There are a series of levels that divide the vertex structure of this graph, where the levels are dictated by the cardinality of the edge length of the dipath away from a particular root to your terminal vertex of interest.
Just a question. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking of a construction of space, or are you thinking of a construction of space-time?
It's purely space. There's nothing. There's no causal structure on this.
There's a preconceived notion of what time is. This direction.
Yeah. This directionality is not corresponding to any notion of causal structure. It's purely a combinatorial structure that we use to represent this data. You can, in fact, find other representations that don't have directed graphs in this case. This is just the convenient parameterization of the combinatorial space that we're using. So there is a series of weights that we attach to every vertex of this combinatorial graph. And those weights are parameterized by some set of omegas. And lastly, there's this KD star structure at each level of our graph that tells us about the connectivity of this combinatorial state. And so now it would be absolutely proper of me to go through and rigorously define these things for you, give you an intuition for what these things are and the type of states that we're really considering. But I'm actually going to hold off from doing that. The reason is that although this is sort of a parameterization of the space of states, it is not the precise space that we're interested in. The precise space is actually a highly constrained version of this. And the constraints are such that you essentially have a union of tons of inequalities on determinants and other geometric inequalities. And as a result, the space is very obscure, and also the inequalities themselves are entirely unilluminating. It would make for a really terrible talk to sit here and really define these states for you in terms of their combinatorial description. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass to another space. And this other space is going to be much easier to interpret. It is going to be a space of embedded graphs. And here, sort of our graph representation is purely just a representation of some combinatorics. In our embedded space, we're actually thinking about the graphs as the states themselves. So most importantly, I can show you nice pictures, and we could actually get some geometric intuition for the types of states that we're considering. So we're not just sort of sweeping the actual space of interest under the rug where our action is defined. We can rigorously define some surjection from the space of embedded graphs back onto our combinatorial space. So every one of these embedded graph states will correspond uniquely to one state in our combinatorial space. And that map can be a multi-cover of our combinatorial space. So essentially, this embedded graph space is much less constrained. So it gives us a lot more freedom to sort of talk about things and sample things more freely. And what we pick up sort of on the other side is a lot more gauge freedom and multi-covers of the spaces that we're actually interested in. So you never really get anything for free. But this at least allows us a domain to talk about things a little bit more concretely. So if you buy that, yep.
Where is this multi-covering? Are you going to describe it?
Yes. Yeah, we will see that as we go through. So I won't construct the map explicitly in terms of literally map to map to map. But we'll do a geometric construction of this map, and you'll see how multiple states can be mapped to a single combinatorial state. So these embedded graph states that we're considering, the graphs are simple undirected graphs. By simple, I mean there are no single node loops, and there are no multi-edges connecting two distinct points. And by an embedding, I mean some injection from the vertex set into a set of points on some flat Euclidean space of finite dimension m. The embedding acts on the edge set such that we have edges mapped to straight line segments between the points of interest. So you can really think about sort of geodesically embedded graphs, straight line simple graphs, as you would visualize them in some Euclidean space. So we work with EM as an ambient space for a variety of reasons. The foremost of which is we would like to make contact with traditional notions of geometry, which at the highest level is sort of a manifold. At best, underneath that is a triangulation of some manifold. Underneath that should be simplicial complexes. And without loss of generality, we would like to work with flat simplicial realizations of some of these graphs. We can generalize without any cost to more curved spaces and think about cellular decompositions of manifolds instead. But we gain a lot of computational toolkit when we restrict to sort of convex conditions and simplicial decompositions of things. So we work with a flat space, and for some technical reasons, we don't want to work with weird periodic spaces or spaces with holes in them, non-trivial genus. And we work with a space that has fixed embedding dimension m, although nothing in our construction explicitly depends on the dimension of the ambient space. And so this is especially relevant for questions of the quantum gravity type, because we could ask things like, given a state space or given a state that's allowed to explore an arbitrary dimensional configuration, is there something that peaks classically around lower dimensional manifolds, say a four-dimensional manifold or four-dimensional triangulation? So our embedding space is really just a very large dimensional playground. And we can explore optimizations as we let that embedding space assume larger and larger dimensions. Lastly, I'll introduce a notion of boundary states. Here, in the embedded language, we're just thinking about embedded convex hull disjoint graphs. So you have two graphs, and initially, you pick some embedding of these graphs, and for the duration of your sort of optimization, they remain non-dynamical in the sense that they're fixed in their embeddings, and they can't change their internal adjacency structure. So from here, our stochastic process on this embedded space is a finite horizon Markov chain. So we perform a perturbation either of the graph state, as long as it respects, of course, the boundaries that I've just defined, or a perturbation of the embedding map itself, again, respecting the boundaries. And we choose a set of moves that are designed to try to sample a full space, which is essentially the space of all possible embeddings of all possible graphs. It's a very large space. But the moves that we choose are, again, chosen to try to promote ergodicity in this space and well-mixing in this space. We have very small moves, such as just a local perturbation of one of your bulk nodes. Or you could have very large non-local global moves, such as adding a new vertex and connecting it arbitrarily to a series of other nodes. So at each step, we perform, at each step of our Markov process, we essentially use a Metropolis filter to select out our states.
Are you going to show all the sets of moves you're using?
No, I don't have the full set of moves. There are 10 that we pick.
Can you just say what you, because you know,
sure,
you
I mean,
choose the sets of move on, particular sets of move on graph.
Sure. So for right. So you might be referring to something like if you have like a CDT, for example, if you already have a triangulation, your set of moves might be Packner moves, things that respect some of the simplicial structure, things like that. We have no such requirements here. Essentially have vertex addition and subtraction, edge addition and subtraction, edge splitting moves and edge recombining moves, and large
nodal displacement.
Nodal displacement would be just taking it's a perturbation of the embedding map for one of the bulk nodes. So you take one of your bulk nodes that's embedded, and you simply perturb it in the ambient space. Right.
All the others are moves on the graph.
The others are moves on the graph, or additionally moves with respect to the embedding space as well.
Like what?
I mean, you can think about performing multiple things simultaneously if you want to compose them. So you can think about taking a node that has many connections and splitting that node into two nodes where they each share some ratio of their connections, and you place them in the ambient space. So that's sort of a perturbation both of the adjacency structure of the graph state as well as the embedding state itself, the embedding map.
So when you do splitting like that, how do you choose where you place them? Does it matter, or is that part of the data?
No, that's a part of the data. It's a part of the sampling process. So you
create an infinite number.
Yes.
So
yeah. No. You're working in a continuum. That's correct. Yeah.
So you're working in a continuum.
Yeah. So the embedding itself is continuum. Yeah. The embeddings aren't on some finite lattice. Yeah. Right. So at each step, we're going to evaluate our cost function, which in this case will be our combinatorial action. If the action is lowered, of course, we accept the move. If the action is increased, we still accept the move with some conditional probability, according to our Metropolis filter, that's based on the size of the action perturbation as well as the simulation temperature. So we have some finite simulation temperature. With a simulated annealing, we'll gradually lower this temperature. And as a result, we attempt to sample, at best, or at worst, local branch minima of our state space. So our goal is to build an ensemble of optima.
So what do you mean by minima?
Minima with respect to your cost function in the network language, or your action, otherwise.
Where is your cost function?
We'll definitely get there, yeah, in just a moment. In fact, roughly now. So our action, our cost function that we're going to be using is going to be gravitationally motivated. So of course, on manifolds, you have the traditional Einstein-Hilbert action. If you have a discretization of your manifold, you're doing Regge calculus, which is applicable strictly to just one triangulation of a d-dimensional manifold. And so when you have a triangulation, you're already making a lot of assumptions about simplicial structure. You're already making a lot of assumptions about where your curvature is concentrated on the d-2 subsimplices of your triangulation. And so there's a lot of additional structure that comes with regicalculus and comes with triangulation discretizations of GR that we simply don't have in this very generic graph space state. So our question is really, what do we do? And what we'd like to do is build combinatorial analogs of the regi action. So the way that we're going to go about doing this is we're going to construct out of our state space, or we're going to construct a state space of abstract simplicial complexes, which we will give a full definition for, as well as triangulations will be mapped to things like disjoint unions of what we call proper pruned skeletons. Notions of volumes will be replaced by some combinatorial weights. And lastly, notions of curvature will be given by what's known as the forming curvature. It's a type of combinatorial curvature that we'll also define. So this is just a preview of what's to come. So this is really going to be defining for us this map, which takes us back from this embedded graph state into our combinatorial state. Of course, again, we can sample the combinatorial state directly if we'd like, but the amount of restrictions on the constraints sort of make it very unfeasible to talk about it abstractly like this. So traditional simplicial complex, these are two embeddings of a simplicial complex and an abstract simplicial complex. Of course, with a simplicial complex, you have a lot of constraints on your boundary matings, right? The intersection of any two simplices must occur in the union of their boundaries, which is also a lower dimensional simplex. And we don't have such requirements with an abstract simplicial complex. Here, you're allowed arbitrary convex intersection of your simplicial objects. So it's a much more generic type of complex, and it's much more combinatorial in nature, and it also allows for a wider range of geometric defects, or things that can be interpreted as geometric defects. So we're going to take our generic graph state, which itself is just a graph, it's just an edge set, and we're going to map it bijectively to a clique complex. So a clique, or a complete subgraph, is a set of nodes, set of d plus 1 nodes, that are all interconnected. So we're going to label all the complete subgraphs of our state, denoted some alpha sub d. Alpha is just an indexing on that set. And each complete subgraph is in bijection with a simplex. And we're going to assert that there really is some simplex for every complete subgraph. So this is in contrast to a simplicial complex in an example here, where you have a complete subgraph of order 3, and there is no associated 2 simplex there. So for every complete subgraph of our edge set, we will actually have an associated simplex. So once we have this clique complex, we're going to define skeletons with respect to this as disjoint unions over all the complete subgraphs of a given order. Graphically, our zero skeleton is just the disjoint set of nodes. Our one skeleton is the edge set. Our two skeleton is the set of two simplices, of course. And our three skeleton in this particular case is this isolated tetrahedron. So as I mentioned, it's not generically true that for a particular embedding of this graph state, all of these simplices that we're defining actually have some geometric realization, right? Their underlying polytopes or their underlying polyhedra may be intersecting in various ways, and you're unable to define a proper simplicial volume for these objects. So if we would like to connect to geometry in a more traditional sense, we're going to have to find some way of pruning back to a simplicial complex. And the way that we do this is we take our abstract simplicial complex, this embedded abstract simplicial complex, and we decompose it as a superposition of skeletons. So each state is decomposed into these particular skeletons, where every complete subgraph has first proper volume, proper simplicial volume, in the sense that your complete subgraph wasn't degenerate in the space. And additionally, each element has empty convex intersection with its neighbors of the same skeleton. So graphically, our point and edge set skeletons remain the same, but we can see in our two skeleton, the proper pruned version has the upper two simplices pruned away. And this pruning happens unambiguously. So you don't do it in steps. If there are any intersections, you remove them all unilaterally for uniqueness purposes. We could also see that the isolated two simplex that was intersecting the front two surfaces of this tetrahedron, all three of those two simplices are removed out of this element of the skeleton. And what you have remaining is just simplicially connected, geometrically realized elements that are the former parts of the tetrahedron. And lastly, our three skeleton is completely removed because we've removed elements of its boundary in earlier skeletons. So this sort of intersection process can be very rigorously defined. I'm sort of giving you a graphical representation of this. And I'm also very suggestively labeling these proper pruned skeletons as these KD stars. And these objects are actually precisely the objects which give the combinatorial data that parameterize half of our original combinatorial state space. So you can imagine the kind of work that you have to do to actually describe some of these things in terms of the inequalities. It's far, far messier than just illustrating it graphically with an embedded graph. So in terms of volumes, our combinatorial analogs will actually be given just by simplicial volumes, just like you would in a traditional Regi formalism. So every complete subgraph in our KD stars now has the potential to have a properly defined simplicial volume. And we assign a weighting, these omegas, provided by that simplicial volume. So this is a combinatorial map. There are no sort of units attached to this. It's simply a map into the positive reals.
You mean, are they necessarily convex?
Yes. Because each complete subgraph. It's not a volume of the skeleton. It's a volume of each complete subgraph, which itself is a simplex, which has simplicial volume.
Confused. If you have a complete graph in dimension 3, you can certainly have embedding of graph
char, non-convex. Because of our embedding process, right, the straight line embeddings, everything that you have at the end of the day is, you know, if you're starting from an abstract simplicial complex in some particular embedding, where this embedding respects those that edge map or the straight lines between the points. Sure, but that's not a simplex. It's not.
You mean it has more than three edge? Is that what you're saying?
Sure. I mean it's not a complete subgraph on those nodes. Not every vertex is connected.
No, I missed that rule. So what's?
So
your thing is only simplex you're embedding.
Right, you only have, you're working in the space of these abstract simplicial complexes.
So you only have simplices.
Right, or potential to have simplices, although they may not have geometric realization of their underlying polyhedra in a particular embedding. That's what this pruning process takes care of.
So where does it stop at 3? I can have.
It could be arbitrarily large.
But then you need to have an arbitrarily large embedding space.
We work at fixed embedding space. You can have complete subgraphs that exceed the dimensionality of your embedding space, but then you won't have a geometrically realized simplex anymore. You'll have the complete subgraph, which you can map to a simplex, but it won't be geometrically realized, and it'll be pruned in this pruning process. So it'll only leave you with the ones that do have the proper linear span in the space that you're embedding in.
So if you complete the volume of these ones,
correct.
You put them away, put them to zero, or?
Yeah, the ones that don't have the proper span are removed out of their respective skeletons. Correct. And the volumes can be, because we're working in the space of simplices, the volumes are trivially computed by the Cayley-Menger determinant. So a nice closed form expression for the volumes. So the last piece that we need to fully define our action is a notion of curvature. There is what's known as the Forman curvature, which was derived by Robin Forman in probably the early 2000s, which is generated from the Bochner-Weizenbach decomposition of the combinatorial Laplace operator. It is really sort of the holy grail of combinatorial geometry to find combinatorial analogs of Riemannian curvature objects. It's really no unique way to do it, no well-defined way to do it, and no way to do it that anyone has seen to be convincing enough in the sense that it really reduces to our traditional Riemannian objects. However, this particular type of curvature happens to have really strong homological properties that make it a nice analog to the Riemannian Ricci curvature. So already you're starting off with one of the strongest analogs of curvature that we have in the combinatorial realm. This type of curvature depends on the near non-local data of the skeletal structures. And you can define a really natural inner product on the space of complexes where this curvature is defined, that gives rise to some positive combinatorial weights. And so these weights serve to generalize the form and curvature. I can give you an example of what the form and curvature looks like explicitly. I will not derive it for you today. The combinatorial weights that I was claiming are coming from the inner product in the cell complex are denoted by these omegas.
Can you say what these are?
They are free parameters. They're just combinatorial weights. You can assign them all to unity. You could assign them all to 7. They could be given by some topological properties. They are completely free in the definition for the form and curvature.
Depend only on the type of the syntax?
No, they're completely arbitrary. They're just numbers in R+.
Which depends on the embedding or not?
Nope. It's just if you have a cell, then you can define some number on that cell. And it can be, and you can generalize the form and curvature to include that number. So what we're actually...
You choose that number when you update your graph.
So this is what I'm getting to. For us, like if you didn't have something to guide you here, you would have an entire huge set of free parameters, which would be really awful. Nothing would be specified at all. For us, as the combinatorial weights that are accompanying the form and curvature, we actually take the same weights, the same volumetric set of weights that we've defined earlier. That's why I've used this very suggestive notation with the same omegas.
I'm not sure. Earlier, when you defined the moves, there was no weight there.
So that's correct.
The question is, how do you update the move, the weights after a move? So there are weights before the move, and
correct.
After the move, what's the update?
So when you recompute all the simplicity of volumes.
So omega is the simplicity of volume?
Correct.
That's what you're taking.
Yes, in this case, yeah. In the generic form and curvature, it doesn't have to be simplicity of volumes. It could be anything.
I know.
So it's our model ansatz that we take it to be actually the same simplicity of weights. Correct. Yeah, it is part of the data that we're building into the model that for the form and curvature, we take the same simplicity of weights that's derived from the geometric embedding data. This gives an intrinsic. It lets the form and curvature sort of read some of the intrinsic geometric data from the embedding. So it's not purely based on combinatorics alone, or sort of raw combinatorics. It's not based purely on adjacency structure. It also knows about the size of the embeddings. Yeah?
And what's the difference here between the alphas and alpha tildes?
The alpha tildes are all the alphas which aren't alpha tilde. All of the other complete subgraphs in a given skeleton that aren't the alpha that you're considering computing the curvature of.
Right.
It's all of the other ones, right?
So it's the sum of the alpha tilde.
Right.
Right.
Yep. All of the for each alpha tilde that's not your alpha, right? All right. So given all of these ingredients, we can patch it together in something that looks like volume-weighted curvatures, which is sort of our nice sort of gravitationally motivated combinatorial action. We have combinatorial volumes. We have combinatorial curvatures. We do a sum over all simplicial structures, all complete subgraphs that live in these KD star proper prune skeletons. And again, we sum over all simplicial scales. So this action is. Yes. These are coupling constants which can be used to differentially weight all the slices of the action, just some free parameter. For the rest of the talk, we're going to take all those couplings to be unit.
So can you say some problem with this form and curvature when you take it to be the coming from the embedding volume? How close it is it an approximation? What is known about this?
Nothing is actually known about it. At best, there is a little bit that's known in terms of if you take the weights to have some valence data, then you can begin to recover something like Gauss-Bonnet theorem with respect to this curvature form. But there's nothing explicitly that's been done. In one of Forman's sort of unpublished papers, he makes a little note of something that you might want to try to consider imbuing the Forman curvature with embedded simplicial volumes in the limit when your cellular complex becomes a cellular decomposition of a manifold. He doesn't speculate as to what that might buy you, just that it might be interesting. And we're sort of taking him up on that offer and seeing what you get out of it.
But can you say what's the right, I mean, there's many things you can, here you take a specific combination.
Correct.
I mean, it has to be dimensionless, that's okay. Mm-hmm. What are the other rationale behind its construction?
Behind the construction of the action?
No, the
or,
form and curvature.
I mean, the form and curvature is...
Why this combination and not some other? What's the rationale?
I mean, the form and curvature is given by the forming. I'm not entirely sure I understand
but,
the...
Yeah, but, you know...
I mean, why that particular set of weights?
I can come up and give you a curvature. Why don't you work with my curvature or Lee's curvature?
What so...
Is, what's special about...
Sure.
Everybody could come up with
right.
combinations of weights.
On... For combinatorial analogs of curvature that are valid on like very generic spaces, like the spaces that we're considering, specifically this very generic space of quasi-convex cellular complexes, which of which these particular proper pruned skeletons are subsets, you have very limited options for combinatorial curvatures.
If you go back, not to the definition, to I could look. You took a sum. I could put -4, and then
right. This I mean this.
The ratio,
sure. This curvature.
The formula I can write, which will
right. This curvature comes from a decomposition of the combinatorial Laplace operator.
Laplace. Okay.
Yeah.
So what's yeah? Can you say more about it? So what's the?
So.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, if you take the Bochner-Weizenbach decomposition of the combinatorial Laplace operator, you're left with two terms. One is a sort of symmetric matrix term, and the other term can be interpreted as this curvature term. It has, like as I mentioned, it has very strong homological properties that are similar to Riemannian curvature in the limit when your cellular decomposition becomes, or when the limit when your cellular complex becomes a cellular decomposition of a manifold.
So what you're saying is that you start from a definition of a discrete Laplace operator.
Right.
That people kind of agree with. Mm-hmm. Like nearest neighbor difference.
Sure.
And then would you compute with it to get this subject? How do you get this subject?
In the interest of time, I would invite you to read Forman's paper on the decomposition. It's a bit of a process that he goes through in order to formally derive this object. If you would like more motivation as to like why we should consider this a good form of curvature in the first place, yeah. I can say something like to the extent that in the limit when your cellular complex becomes a decomposition of some manifold, the form and curvature on all the edges, if you make a restriction that all of these form and curvatures are negative on all the edges, then it has very strong homological restrictions on the type of manifold that you can have, the type of combinatorial manifold. And you get the same restrictions back out if you take the Riemannian Ricci curvature to be negative over the space. And so you have these really nice analogs that you pull strictly topologically. So there are various conditions that that Forman goes through, sort of computing interesting scenarios where he can really bring to light some of the interesting correspondences between this very combinatorial form of curvature and a more traditional Riemannian analog. But like I said, there are many different ways that you could define a combinatorial curvature, and there is no golden bullet. One thing that you can consider is like the nil curvature, for example, which is a purely valence-weighted curvature. That nil curvature has a very nice description in terms of a Gauss-Bonnet theorem. However, it completely misses any mention of embedding spaces. It has no tie to intrinsic geometry of your space. So for our purposes, we find that measure of curvature to be unsuitable. And so we pick this measure of curvature because it allows us to imbue it not only with the adjacency structure and the combinatorial structure, but also some intrinsic geometric data from the embedding space. And that's pretty much your only options in terms of good combinatorial curvatures that have nice homological properties that could also do this. Is that sufficient?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Right. The last element that we need is the cosmological term. So we have an analog, a combinatorial analog of some cosmological constant, which is just some scalar curvature offset to the Forman curvature, which you could think of as being inherited from the ambient space. Right, so there's one last thing that I sort of swept under the rug, which was the weights on the points. Right? If everything was derived from simplicial volumes, what are the volumes on the points? The answer to that is that you simply have a series of free parameters again. Geometrically, all of our points are equivalent, and so we make another ansatz that for our model, we assign just one single combinatorial weight to the set of all points. So each point gets the same weight. And by the Forman curvature, these weights have to be positive, positive real. You can ask, sort of naturally, if you wanted to violate the constraints in the Forman curvature, if you set it to zero, what would you get out of the action phenomenologically? And the answer is that you would introduce an equivalence class of networks under disconnected point addition. So you can have a state which has an infinitely dense sea of points be geometrically equivalent to some nice network state. So you lose sort of all geometric interpretation of your data at that point. So it's a largely phenomenologically disfavored thing to do, not to mention it's mathematically disfavored. Just a little side note. So we have one other free parameter on which our network growth can depend, which is the point volume. Once we establish that you do have a positive point volume, we can run a very similar argument on lambda. And you'll see that if you don't have your cosmological term being positive, you will end up with a regime that has an infinite number of disconnected parts. So you will end up growing these very, very bizarre looking graphs, which have a lot of disconnected pieces. So we'll see this explicitly in some of our simulations. So what I can show you today is some examples of how this actually plays out. What are the optimum of the states? I certainly...
You minimize that guy.
Yes. Yes, minimizing that action. I certainly wouldn't be here today if we go through this sort of very ad hoc construction and you don't get anything out at the end of the day. So I'm sure you're all very curious what this can actually buy you. The most sort of basic toy example that we can think about is a 1D embedding, right? This is sort of the basic case where we could think about maybe partially triangulating some elements of the real line, and we can ask what might grow in between. If we sort of cross our fingers and really hope, you might have a nice geometrically realized, simplicially attached object at the end of the day. That might be your sort of classical state in many sense. So that's certainly not all you can have. You can have many disconnected points. You could have a lot of non-geometrically realized elements. You could have things that are not simplicially attached. We're working in a very, very large generic space. And so having sort of nice things which will lead you to notions of geometry are combinatorially rare. So I can show you that if we look in the regime where our cosmological term is negative, as I hinted to you, we end up filling the space with disconnected points. Sort of our emergent geometry that you could see in the upper left, it becomes very dense with these points. And we end up having 0% geometric realization of any complete subgraphs. If we look at a regime where our cosmological term is larger than some critical value, you'll also have 0% geometric realization, but for a very different reason. The system actually begins in its global minimum. So we start on our global optimum, and combinatorially, because of the perturbations, you wind up in a state that becomes maximally connected, because adding something and subtracting it is equivalent under the action, as long as we're not adding any new points, because nothing will be geometrically realized here, and adding an additional point when the cosmological constant is positive is disfavored with respect to minimizing our cost function, so it's minimizing our action. So we end up with building a state that's hyperconnected. You have things like two simplices and three simplices that are being built combinatorially, but of course are not geometrically realized in one dimension. And the really interesting piece is that there is a regime where you do get geometric realization of all the underlying polyhedra, of all of your simplices, with probability 1 if you wait for enough mixing. So there are global minima of the action for certain parameter regimes where you will have the nice sort of triangulation simplicial structure that you would hope to achieve if you're trying to understand how emergent geometry might arrive from a purely combinatorial description. And so one dimension is not very exciting, I admit. So we can look to things in higher dimensions and see whether or not this sort of this paradigm might have any weight. And so if we look in two dimensions, we can see for a negative cosmological term, as I suggested, you have a lot of disconnected pieces. You have a very sort of chaotic system where you end up almost completely ignoring the fact that you've established any boundary state to begin with. For a cosmological term that's much bigger than some critical value, you will again not grow any emergent geometry. But there is a critical range of cosmological terms where you grow not only geometrically realized objects, not only simplicially attached objects, but really some partial triangulation here. And this is highly non-trivial in the combinatorial space. There's really no reason to have a state like this. If you tweak your curvature form even slightly, you really won't have anything like this grow. I've tried many.
You can
do a lot of perturbations of sort of your formalism, right?
Yes.
Like for example, I mentioned those coupling constants, which can be used to differentially weight the slices of your network,
yes,
right?
Yes.
If you tweak those off of unity, you won't get something like this. So there are, if you tried to do this with the nil curvature, you won't have emergent geometry.
So you're trying all your betas are equal to 1?
Yes. All the xi's. Right. So the system
is very unstable under that.
Right. So the system is very robust under the way that it is currently. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I can even show you examples of this happening sort of very sped up, where we can see these optimums being constructed. And you will see the emergence of these very nice simplicial structures with geometric realization. And again, I want to emphasize that we're not pre-assigning your building blocks. We're not pre-assigning your attachment rules. We're not saying anything about prescribing curvature to any particular subsimplex. We're summing over all complete subgraphs in a very generic combinatorial state. And what we get back out is something that can be nicely mapped to realized embeddings.
Can you explain what's the mechanism that gets rid of the intersections?
It's a pretty complicated algorithm. There are a lot of geometric intersection algorithms that you can use. There are shortcuts in one and two dimensions that you can use that are optimized. But I mean, generically, you can think about taking your two simplices, computing the Minkowski difference, and then checking to see whether or not the origin is contained within the convex hull of this object.
I'm asking more, because initially your things could intersect. Right?
Sure.
So is it the wave that subtracts that, or is part of, at some point you describe a move where you remove everything which is kind of intersection?
Right.
I'm trying to understand whether you remove that mass by n, or it's the wave that you remove it.
The pruning happens.
It happens
at two levels. First of all, you have to see whether or not your object has simplicial volume, right? That is to say, if you have a complete subgraph of order 7 embedded in one dimension, it's clearly not having simplicial volume. So your first
you take it out.
That's removed, right? From anything that's remaining, now you check to see whether or not there's empty convex intersection with its neighbors in that
then
skeleton.
You that.
Then you remove those
okay.
unilaterally.
That's
right. Correct. So one last thing that we can talk about is some of the properties of this action. The action is it's finite for a finite number of terms. For a finite graph, the action is finite. However, it's not intrinsically positive definite. So as a result, with network growth, you may actually be unbounded in your global minimum. So one thing that you can do as a sort of a toy to probe this behavior is to add a simplicial probe to a given network state and to understand some of the limiting behavior of the simplicial probe. So you can compute the fluctuation in the action quite trivially. And what you'll find is the action actually has an ultraviolet divergence, or a very small length scale divergence. So if I add a simplicial probe, I can add, so given any generic state, I can perform some epsilon length addition, and it'll immediately unbound the global minimum of your action, which is a very bad behavior. So you can naturally regulate this using the point volume. If you have one of these positive point volumes,
would you call the point volume?
The point volume is the weights that are assigned to every point in your graph, every vertex. Right, there's a weight assignment to every complete subgraph. The vertices have the free parameter given by the weights, the point volume. Right.
So you just, what do? You have to send it to infinity, to zero? To
no, you simply assert that if you have any higher dimensional combinatorial object, it can't have volume less than the point volume. You can't have the combinatorial two volume be less than the combinatorial zero volume. So you simply assert it as a minimum combinatorial cutoff. So you have it as a.
Do that at every layer?
At every layer.
Okay. The three volume must be bigger than the two volume?
Oh, no. It's not chained like that. No. It's strictly with respect to the point. That's right. Yes, that does get rid of all of your UV divergences, it turns out. If you extend this sort of higher dimensional simplicial attachments, you'll see through a rather extensive calculation that you can regulate all of these small length scale divergences if you treat the point volume as a minimum combinatorial length scale for your system. So it has naturally built in with it some minimum combinatorial length scale. So the infrared also diverges. If you add an infinitely long probe, you will have a divergence of the long length scale structures. So we can draw some interesting analogs to other sort of more rich and more rigorous quantum gravity models. For example, spike divergences in spin foam models. If you're not regulating your gauge group with a quantum deformation, you can have these large spike structures. In something like a CDT, you can have branch polymers, you can have branching universes. So there are a lot of sort of more closely tuned to the quantum gravity physics models, which also see these large scale infrared divergences in their sort of naive implementations. Of course, Euclidean dynamical triangulations have a long history of having states of either Hausdorff dimension infinite or Hausdorff dimension 2 with large branch polymer geometries. So we find it very interesting that even at the combinatorial level, we also see a divergence of the very same kind. And it's perhaps a goal that finding a way to regulate the infrared at the combinatorial level might give us some insight on regulating other structures, other geometric structure divergences. And one last thing that we can examine is whether or not there are non-trivial equivalence classes of states under the action. So not simply gauge transformations, but actual symmetries of the action. So one way that we can do this is to consider some regular simplicial building block. By regular simplex, I mean all uniform edge lengths. And we can look at contours in the action space. So for example, you can find the action in closed form, which is why we picked this example. It's a very simple toy example. And we can search, for example, for degenerate solutions for action equals zero. And what we find in this particular case is the solution set forms manifolds. And not only does it form manifolds, but it forms manifolds that have multi-value behavior for given point volume in cosmological term. So we're looking at solution sets to action equals zero, and on the right for a 20 simplex, and on the left for a 2 simplex.
And you're looking for flat directions.
We're looking for flat directions in the action, correct. And we do see, for a given point volume in cosmological term, multiply sized regular simplices that will both that will solve this equation. So
where do you focus on S equals zero? Just
we're just looking at a particular contour.
Sure.
Yeah. Just to try to understand some of the generic behavior of the action. So, I mean, in addition to seeing this multivalue behavior, we also see large regimes where we don't have such multivalue behavior, at least numerically. This is not a rigorous proof by any means. And so this is perhaps giving us, in one interpretation, some constraints on the allowable parameter regimes.
What do you mean by multivalue behavior?
Say that. I mean that the manifold is folds on itself such that you can have multiply sized regular simplices that are solution sets to action equals zero, for example.
The discrete sets? Or
no.
Or continuum sets?
They can be continuum sets. And so this actually has, so in addition to the parameter regimes itself, it actually has a lot of implications for simulation ergodicity, that you can translate along one of these flat directions and drop into a new vacua. So there are a lot of topological considerations that we have to think about for something generic like this. And I would like to draw another analogy to something similar that you would see in 3NJ symbols, which constitute the vertex amplitudes of a spin foam. So the exceptional zeros of 3NJ symbols, there's an open hypothesis right now that these exceptional zeros are sufficiently diffuse and sparse in the space of a generic spin foam state. Otherwise, you end up with interesting domain walls, and you have some sampling problems. And so it is true that for specifically a 3J symbol, the space of exceptional zeros does form a manifold. But for higher NJ symbols and more coupled 3NJ symbols, this space actually breaks its degeneracy. And it's conjectured that for a really generic spin foam state, that these exceptional zeros are sufficiently distributed. So we also have a complementary hypothesis that for these regular simplicial building blocks, the solutions are maybe multi-valued and may have manifold solutions. But for a generic network state, these symmetries are actually broken enough that we don't have such behavior. And so I suppose to conclude, I hope to have given you just a little bit of a flavor of what we're looking at in terms of trying to understand whether or not there are sort of nice models, sort of as natural as can be in the space of combinatorics, that can lead us to an understanding of emergent geometry. Sort of minimally prescribed paradigms where we don't explicitly state the building blocks that we're using or how they're attached, but can sample in a very generic combinatorial space and provide maps to more traditional embedding spaces. So there are still tons of open questions. As I mentioned, this formalism is still very much in its infancy. It's just giving us sort of very nice glances into the potential for nice geometric objects as classical states. We've talked a little bit about some of the open questions that are remaining, not in the least of which is whether or not in the limit that you do have a simplicial decomposition of a manifold, you actually return to a more familiar construction, whether or not we can make contact with something like a Reggie action explicitly. And of course, I think we're all acutely acquainted with the state of modern funding. And so if you would like to try to sort of boost your funding outside of the quantum gravity realm, the paradigm of emergent networks is really rich and can be applied to a variety of other problems. So for example, you can take sort of the generic setup like this, and instead of trying to understand emergent geometry, you could understand sort of whether or not there are optimal social networks that might connect to established social networks, or whether or not there's an optimal neural network, or sort of pick your flavor of something that's interesting to you and can be sort of explored with this sort of generic framework that we're looking at. Of course, I prefer emergent geometry. But generically, there are a lot of things to do with this framework. There are a lot of open questions left to explore. And it really lends itself nicely to numerical simulation. And so we hope to have presented a little bit about sort of the emergent geometry petri dish of networks that you can grow. And hopefully, in the future, we'll have some more exciting results to show. Thank you. So, questions? Yes?
So when you get the IR divergence, what kind of cosmological constant in action?
It doesn't matter. So yeah, you can have a positive cosmological constant, you'll still have that divergence. Certainly with a negative, you'll have the divergence. But even with certain regimes of positive, you will still have that divergence.
These examples that you showed of 2D emergent geometries, they look like there was no internal vertex. I don't know if it's relevant or it's just an example to have two pictures.
So here there are 1, 2, 3, 4 internal vertices
okay,
here.
This one, okay, yep. It just okay. In the other.
Yes? One of the cool things is that in your certain regime of cosmological constant, your graph becomes kind of simplicial regular graph.
Right.
Do you have some more intuitive understanding of why this happens mathematically?
So on the combinatorial level, I think you're dealing with a balance between these weights, which are strictly positive definite, and the Forman curvature, which is often negative for a lot of situations. And so you might be sort of having this trade-off between large connectivity in your graph and large volume. And they're sort of they're complementary. They can be inversely related in many aspects. And so in the nice regimes, you have these situations where you have sort of a balance entropically between large connectivity and large volumes. But really understanding the nature of these minima and whether or not there are, you know, really the structure of the minima in the combinatorial space is very much underway. All right, thank you.